Welcome to the PeopleStack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk, founder of Jen Bunk Ventures and creator of PeopleStack Academy. My guest for this episode is Katie Greenman, founder of HumanSide. Welcome, Katie.
Hello, hello.
Hello. Here. How are you today?
Wonderful.
That's great to hear.
Yeah.
Always good to have people in a wonderful mood when we're doing an interview.
So
let's get started. Let's talk about HumanSide. Mm-hmm. What is HumanSide? How did you get started with it? What are you currently working on?
Absolutely. HumanSide is my company that started when I was in grad school. I started to conceptualize it a little bit. I initially went into a doctorate program to study human development and the social and emotional side of leadership. And while I was in that program, I was finding myself frustrated because the research is already written for the most part, or at least the research that I went in there to discover. I found myself kind of repeating studies or being stuck in the methodology and stats of research, but not really going for the impact of why I'd started in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so I just found, like, you know, there's a lot of information about human beings and what makes us thrive and what's important to us. That I think if people knew that there's a little bit more evidence behind, we'd take it a little bit more seriously. And so that's why I'd gotten into the research side of things, was like, okay, obviously something's missing. People don't get why human beings are suffering, so I'm going to go figure it out. We actually do know a lot about it. And so I started to look at, okay, if we know a lot of information and we have it, how come we aren't implementing it? And so HumanSide came out of that hunger of mine. How do we translate this research, but also the wisdom that's out there? If there's not, you know, stats behind it, there's a lot of people with a lot of wisdom and experience to offer. Mm-hmm. And so the four intersections are translational research, improv comedy, facilitation, and the fourth one, which I can't remember right now, but it's a good time.
It's a good time. And we'll get to all of that. I definitely want to talk about improv comedy a little bit. Mm-hmm. But let's just stay on the business side of things a little bit more. Like, so what are you currently working on? What kinds of projects do you are currently taking on? Do you like to take on?
Absolutely. So I feel really lucky. I'm working with three bigger projects right now, and all of them share the intention of, like, transforming leadership culture a bit. So either giving people the tools. One of the groups I work with is She Geeks Out, which is this community in Boston working with women in leadership positions. And we are doing a professional development series just to have the conversation of, like, how do we be a better leader? You know, what are the conversations that can help us strengthen these muscles that we might not otherwise have a space to? Kind of like a gym for that part of ourselves.
That's awesome. I had Felicia and Rachel from She Geeks Out on the podcast. So check it out if you're listening.
Do it. They are great humans. They're great.
Yes.
So that's one, doing a professional development series. Another with the City of Boston or the Boston Chamber of Commerce. We're building out this program called City Awake Delegates, which is looking at how do we engage the young adults who are 40% of the population of Greater Boston, but not as much a part of the actual city agenda. Yeah. So what kind of programs can we design or experiences can we create to bring us out and bridge that gap between, like, even I've been here about 9 years in the Greater Boston area, and I still feel like I don't have a sense of how to feel like the city is mine. So how do we solve that issue?
Yeah, although I've been here this time for, almost 2 years now. I've been here and back. Mm-hmm. And I kind of go through that similar thing. It has that very nice sort of family feel, that small city, not quite small town, but definitely a small city feel.
Right.
But there are times where you feel like I can't possibly stay on top of, first of all, everything that's going on and everything that's changing.
Right. 100% agree. And that's been my issue too. It's like I have my neighborhood and I have the organizations that I'm a part of and I'm involved in those. But in terms of, like, the city and the policies and what's on the docket and what affects me or what should I have a say in.
Right.
I don't know. You don't know where to start. So this is one of the intentions we have, is how do we make it more digestible?
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. So when you're doing and designing these leadership trainings, you mentioned the stats, but that you also just mentioned the wisdom, that there's wisdom out there that's beyond the stats.
Yep.
That's really interesting to me, given my background as a former researcher, former professor. But I think that a lot of people can relate to the, can you just speak speaking of human, can you just speak human to me? You know, I don't necessarily need a bunch of stats. Can you just give me that wisdom? So how do you approach that? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, I just think of my mentors, their names are Rich and Yvonne Dutra St. John, and they founded this program called Challenge Day. And Rich, he does have a master's, but they founded this incredible program. And if you look it up, Challenge Day goes to high schools and is this catalytic event that just plants the seed of, okay, young people, like, this is your world. This is your place to have power. You got this. You can do this. You're loved. That kind of conversation. But that started because they were parents and because they had four daughters, ages 2, 3, 4, and 5. And they were worried about their kids growing up in a high school system or a middle school system where they weren't safe, because that was their experience, Rich and Yvonne, when they were growing up. And so they created this incredible experience. Of course, at this point, it's been around for over 25 years. So they have a lot of people from academia around them, but it was started because they freaking loved and they wanted to take care of their kids, and that they saw what didn't work in the schools they were a part of and what wanted to offer what they think could work. Mm-hmm. And it didn't come from reading a book or quoting, you know, Malcolm Gladwell.
Right.
And they tend to be really involved in the spiritual side of things in moments. Like, that isn't the foundation of their work at all, but that's a piece that I've gotten curious about in my life, is like, who are these wise leaders? And like, indigenous groups, right? They've been around for a long time. There's wisdoms being passed down. What do they have to offer, even if I'm not putting, you know, an R and a P behind it?
Right, right. So do you incorporate stats at all?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Especially because we're based out of Boston. And that's why I'm intentionally in Boston, which I consider, you know, one of the intellectual capitals. I choose to be here and Humanside to be here because I think that there is research to justify some of the wisdom, and that's one of the bridges that I'm passionate about helping cross.
Right. Yeah. Right. Before or earlier, when you were talking about your training and when you're going through your academic training, that first, when you first started out, you felt like there wasn't anything new under the sun. Like, the stuff that you were doing seemed to be kind of sort of the same thing that's already been done.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of things there were you discovering?
Yep.
Just kind of asking that because there may be folks out there that may not be aware of any of the leadership research that's out there.
Yep.
So it may be a nice way of sort of pinging at the what are the sort of the tried and true research findings that people tend to keep, you know, doing over and over again.
Absolutely. And I want to clarify too, because the lab that I was a part of is super innovative, you know, in character development. And so they do some really big pioneering studies, but they share the same conversations in different organizations. So a lot of it was program evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
So I did learn a lot, but when in my outside readings, it was like, okay, why do, you know, what's this thing called loneliness? Why is this so painful? Okay, wait, we're a social species. So if I deprive myself of social connection and authentic, you know, genuine interactions as a human being, that hurts me, and both on a physiological and psychological level. And one of the things that came out while I was in the program was this field of social epigenetics, which is looking at the genome and how our genes change over time and that possibility.
Yeah.
And it was looking at the social side of it. And so it wasn't that the new research findings weren't coming out. It's just that they kept reiterating the same point of like, we need authentic connection. We depend on each other as human beings. There's the in-group and out-group phenomenon, that the more we get to know the people around us genuinely, the less we tend to hurt them or want to hurt them, and the more we're inclined to help them.
Yeah.
So it wasn't so much that there was a lack of findings. It was just that we kept re-emphasizing these huge points that I think are so important.
Right. And let's emphasize them. Let's bring them out to the masses.
Right.
And researchers, as I learned, which is a little bit of a hard lesson to learn, researchers are not always trained to be the best marketers and business people. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the biggest shifts that I've felt, that there's this hedging kind of language that you're taught when you're going through academic training. You can't say that causes that. You can't say that this is definitively the answer to this. You have to always, at least you're taught this way.
Mm-hmm.
What are the caveats? What are the limitations? And I was kind of brought up to add 2 or 3 sentences to whatever I said so that people would know that the caveats and limitations. Whereas now I am working on saying less because less is more. You know, just do this. So have you experienced that as well?
Oh my gosh, so much. It took me about a year. So it was a doctorate program, 5-year program. I left after 2 years, got my master's, but I left the program, and it took about a year for me to shake off that insecurity that like I will be nothing without these letters. And especially in Boston, right, where there's so much research and wisdom. But that's the piece that I am starting to, and it might even be, you know, me self-justifying my choices, right, in retrospect. But like, that's their strength. You know, the people in my lab who chose to continue staying there, that is their, it's not even their strength, it's their brilliance. Like, they are incredible methodologists. They are incredible researchers, and they are so freaking good at finding truth and sharing truth. And they are also value that, like, they will own, if truth is like 1 centimeter long, they will acknowledge it's 1 centimeter long. Whereas people in society who don't understand all the limitations, and not even like don't understand, we can comprehend it, but like we don't get why that is, that, you know, or I didn't before I learned all about it. So that piece of like, they are, every word that they say you can count on, because they're very careful with the words that they use. And I'm giving myself permission to take those words and see if I can translate them in multiple ways. And that's my, that's or at least the strength I'm trying to build out a little bit, is translating it so that many people can be at this buffet of truth and see what sticks. And this is the other piece that I feel like, and I, not to discredit research, which tends to go for truth as best as it can, but it's like, that's some, they're offering something, you know, research is offering something. It's either going to stick with me or you or someone else and land and resonate, or it's not, in which case dismiss that research article and try another one. And it's either going to stick or it's not. And so I think that's why with, I'm trying my best, right? And it's a growing edge for me too, of like finding all these intersections and let's see what sticks. And like right now, you know, the election just happened last week. And we're seeing a lot of hate coming out, and that's something that's keeping me up at night, is how do we make these conversations accessible to the people who are yelling at a person to take off her hijab or else they'll burn her alive? You know, like me saying, well, do you know statistically that she's just like you, is not going to resonate. Me saying, hey, if you looked her in the eyes and asked about her story, is not going to resonate. Or maybe it would, but that's the piece. It's like there's 7 billion variations of human. I don't know what's going to resonate with each of us. I'm trying. I would love to find some, what's the word? You know, like some ticket into greater groups.
What's the key? What's the key that unlocks the...
More people than less.
Right. Exactly. And I think that that's... The human connection piece of it, right? You said that there's these bigger themes, these larger themes that you came across. Human connection is one of them. The wanting to feel love, not wanting to feel alone. That these are the themes that do keep coming up, not just in, say, leadership literature, but if you were to just kind of do a broad sweep of, say, the social psych literature or the organizational psych literature, that's what they are. You treat people well, you get along as best as you can, you challenge them in the right ways. When I used to teach and we would go over research articles, I would do my best to find research articles that I think would shock the students, at least in some way. But more times than not, they'd be like, yeah, you know, whatever, this makes sense, you know, if it was something about, like, you know, leader membership exchange, in group out group kind of stuff. Well, of course people are going to act that way, that if you feel like you're in the in group you're going to trust everybody more, and if you're in the out group you're not. What's so mind-blowing about this? And now I'm looking back on that saying, you know, maybe you're right, and that maybe at least one way of approaching this is from the broader sweep, human connection. And you mentioned even spiritual as well, you know, that sort of spiritual motivational aspect to it, I think can be really helpful as an antidote to the overemphasis sometimes on statistics and numbers and research.
And I would even like challenge the kids' conversation of like, it makes sense, in group, out group. And it didn't sound that stupid, I'm sure. But like the piece that's missing, and even in this conversation we're having, right, we're talking from our heads a little bit because this is a conversation, which is fine. But if I slowed down right now enough to like actually think about in-group and out-group, yes, it makes sense cognitively, but you're an out-group to me because you are interviewing me, and I'm an in-group because I'm the one being interviewed, and like I might feel the pressures of like, where is this going to go and how is this going to circulate? And so the students, when it's like, yeah, it makes sense, well, slow down. If it makes sense, who's an out-group to you right now, and how is that affecting your life and your interactions? right. and your sense of contribution to them. So if, as mm-hmm. a student, your outgroup is professors, which we I did some, when we were in universities, there was that conversation. And one of the projects I work on is Dear World, where we go to campuses. And I hear a lot about the divide between faculty, staff, and students. And this, it's a storytelling project where they all share their stories, because like the students forget that that faculty person and staff person was a student once.
Yeah.
And there was one campus we went to where a woman, she had lost her husband in 9/11, you know, in New York City in the Trade Center. And she didn't even, like, she had shared that with us in our project in confidence, but no one knew that. None of the students knew that that was what brought her to this campus. And that's why she lived at this new place and why she was new to the campus. And she refused to share it mm-hmm. with people outside of this like intimate little circle. But I thought that was so interesting of like that humanizing factor that would be the gut wrench that they would need to like shatter that outgroup label and be like, oh wait, you're in pain too.
Yeah.
You know,
let's slow down. Let's think, slow down, but maybe think on your feet a little bit more. Get out of your head mm-hmm. a little bit more and maybe into your heart a little more.
Yeah.
And sometimes getting too much in our head can actually get in, mm-hmm. get in the way.
Yeah, and being, I was, Dr. Mark, he's another name in there, Dr. Mark Hill, I was at a conference yesterday, and he kept being like, you gotta be self-critical. Like, we are so careful about wanting to look good in American culture, and even me, like, I will lie and then catch myself to be like, just kidding, that wasn't true, I said something that looked good. Mm-hmm. But to own, excuse my English, but like, own our shit. Like, I am, mm-hmm. I can be move so fast, I'm being really unintentional with my interactions, and right. I can be hurting people around me, not in like very blatant ways, but mm-hmm. you know, that's, we have to slow down and see our impact and own it and be okay admitting our mistakes, because it's like, it ain't no thing. Right. We're all doing it.
Yeah.
And I think that's a piece of culture that we really need to normalize.
Hey there, folks. We'll get back to the interview in two shakes of a lamb's tail. But first, are you a tech manager? Do you lead teams of geeks through long-term complex projects? If so, check out my free tech leadership webinar where I share the 5-step game plan my clients used to command 200K plus salaries while upping their free time by 20%. Learn strategies for becoming a leadership master and evoking the best performance from every team member, leaving you gushing with pride. To reserve your spot, go to genbunk.com/webinar. That's genbunk.com/webinar. Without further ado, please enjoy the remainder of the interview. What role does improv comedy play in all of this?
Changed my life. It did. It changed my life. So there's Improv Boston in Cambridge. I took my first day of classes, my first week of comedy school was my first week of grad school. Literally simultaneous timing.
Awesome.
Ended up leaving grad school and finishing comedy school. But that community, that craft has changed my life and my skills as a facilitator, just in the sense, and I know some people, I put that in like the bios of human side workshops and people expect to like play goofy games a lot. And it's more of the culture we try to set, because in improv, like, there are no mistakes. There's only offers, and you have to be super present moment with them, so you're actually paying attention. Like on a scene, and you'll notice that people, like there's Improv Asylum in downtown Boston,
yeah.
but a lot of their shows are sketch, so they're written, they're scripted. Whereas Improv Boston is 100% improv, made up on the fly. There aren't, like, they do sketch and stand up as well, but that's three different types of comedy. Improv is like, whose line is it anyway, where you don't know what's gonna happen, it's never gonna happen again. Mm-hmm. And that's because the craft and the muscle that you train yourself in is being so present moment that whatever comes your way, you can actually play with it. And I say play with it really intentionally, because it's a game. It's you play with it and mm-hmm. see where it can mold and where it can go. But you never say no. You never negate. You never reject. Because if you do, and you'll see it happen on stage sometimes, they'll be like, look, I'm a marshmallow. No, you're not. The scene ends.
Automatically end scene. Yeah.
And
yes.
It's so uncomfortable to witness. Like, saying no to an offer makes the scene stop and die, just like in life. Where if you say no to a person and what they're mm-hmm. bringing to this table, the conversation all of a sudden becomes safe and is really hard to move forward. Like, if you said mm-hmm. to me, like, I don't believe in your views, and I'd be like, oh, you're wrong. Great.
Period.
There's mm-hmm. no conversation there where I'd be like, you don't believe in my views. What views do you believe in? and then we're having a conversation and we're building and we're playing with it.
Yeah.
And so that philosophy is something that I very much am trying to be mindful of in the way we design.
And that sounds like a really nice way of approaching potentially contentious situation or conflict management, how to approach someone who may have different views mm-hmm. than you. You play with it. Mm-hmm. You give them at the least the benefit of the doubt, or at the most you say, okay, you're a marshmallow. That's awesome. Tell me a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'll be like, I'm a chocolate, you know?
Right, exactly. What kind of chocolate? Oh, that's cool.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And the other piece is like, it's just, I think there needs to be levity in these conversations that we're having. Like, I'm lucky that I don't suffer from clinical depression, but I joke that I fall into bouts of seriousism where I'm taking myself so serious that I'm paralyzed because I feel like every step I take, if I F up, I'm going to sabotage my career or I'm going to mess up my relationships or... and it happens, like, I say 3 or 4. I just got out of one last month. I had, like, a 2-week bout where I was just, and my partner knows really, we can tell the signs when I'm in that place in my head, and I'm just taking myself so seriously.
Okay.
And improv is that medicine for me of, like, okay, I can't, like, if I take it too seriously, I'm going to be too afraid to fail that I don't move at all. And, right. and, like, with life, I don't want to ever leave the planet. Like, if something were to happen tomorrow, I don't want to have... wasted the last week of my life just taking myself so seriously that I wasn't having a good time, I wasn't enjoying these conversations, and I wasn't appreciating how, and it's gonna sound flowery, but like how beautiful that growth is, that like if I F up, how cool is that I realized it, and now I can like do what I can to prevent it or laugh at myself because it's not that big a deal.
Right.
Yeah.
Failure is a word that comes up a lot in the tech world and among tech leaders. Mm-hmm. And I feel like to some extent, it's been beaten to death a little bit. You know, talking about being so much in your head and not really thinking about what it means. Like, learn. Yeah, okay, we need to fail. We need to fail faster. It's almost like this mantra now.
Right, fail faster.
And people aren't really thinking about what that means. And I was talking to... somebody at a conference, I believe he was a CEO. He was some upper level leader at a tech company. And I basically just trying to start a conversation. I say, what do you think about failing? You know, it's a big word right now. And he looked at me and was like, yeah, you know, it's not always a good thing.
Yeah.
you're right. Because he runs more of like a manufacturing company than a software company. So with software, it's actually a lot easier to bounce back from a failure because you're just talking about lines of code.
Mm.
But when you're talking about manufacturing something, you know, making something out of metal or plastic or whatever, the way that he was explaining to me, if you fail, you lose not only time, but money and product and materials and things like that. So you got to make sure when you make the prototype,
totally,
that you don't want to fail. And then also you don't want to lose money. Mm-hmm. You know, money is the lifeblood of a business.
Right.
And so if you're in this, I was just reading the most recent, Inc. magazine, sort of one of the themes was that a lot of the startups now who are in growth phase, when a lot of the venture capital funding was like, here you go, here's Series A, here's Series B, Series C. But now the venture capitalist sort of like taking a step back saying, oh, I want to see that you can be profitable.
Mm-hmm.
And the tech leaders are like, well, profitable? I thought you just wanted me to grow, right?
Yeah.
So now there's this shift that I see, you know, more and more companies that are either failing, like actually failing, going out of business, or shifting from, okay, we got to shift from growth mode, from a mode where it's just we're constantly bringing in more revenue to making more sales, to a mode where we actually need to start making money on our own. We can't depend on it.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole idea, where did this come from? From the whole idea of failure.
Right.
The whole idea of what does it mean that it's not necessarily 100%. Always a good thing, but that we can absolutely come from a place of this can be a learning. This can be a learning moment. And
totally.
Add levity to it as well.
Yeah, and it's like, it's not, and I agree, like, because the companies, if they don't have a bottom line, they don't exist. So they need to be focused around that. And that makes complete sense. So I would never wish a company to be like, okay, you're hired, now go F up and tell me all about it and we'll celebrate it.
Doesn't that sound ridiculous?
It's actually, I think it was Google. I read an article about F up parties is a thing where like every week they'll have parties with their team and they just celebrate like where you messed up.
Where you messed up.
But that's the thing that I think is... a minor twist, like this culture of failure, I hear that there's some like skepticism around it or fear around it of like, I don't want people to think it's okay to get lazy. But it's less about the actual it's about the mindset. Is what I'm trying to say. It's about the mindset of failure that, like, if I know I'm messing up in an assembly line or in a team project or in a client deliverable, like, I'm quick to acknowledge it, go for help, talk to people, get solutions, and change it, because I'm not sitting here sitting in shame as if, like, if I shine light on this, I am going to be reprimanded. I might lose that promotion. I might not be able to, like, work here. And so the culture of failure needs to change so that people aren't sticking in their silos because they're afraid. You know, like in third grade, if you messed up, you wore the dunce hat in the corner. Like, I had to sit in the hallway so many times. And that was, right, humiliating. And anyone who walked by to the bathroom saw me out there. And they got to, echo that failure that I had messed up. And that's a really shaming experience for a young person. But that's why we as adults still have that trigger of, like, if I get in trouble. Like, that's shameful.
Right.
But it can't, like, that's a young response. Like, the older response is, like, ooh, I messed up. Okay, cool. Acknowledge, solution, build, go, talk. Next steps.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think about mindfulness? And there's been lots more interest and lots of more practice around mindfulness lately. I feel like that's a theme that's relevant to what we've been talking about.
I think it's the same theme of, like, just slowing down. And I went through, like, a 3-month sprint of meditating 2 times a day. Like, I did TM. And it was 20 minutes in the morning and then 20 minutes at 3 o'clock. And I literally felt like I was on anti-anxiety. Like, I could not have felt, I felt so good. And I only did it for 3 months. I lost the practice. I had a really hard time getting it back. But I think back at that time when I was like, so it's just, I think it's important. I think all of us, right, if we let, and my mom does body work called the Feldenkrais Method in cranial sacral therapy, which talks about, like, the wisdom of your physical body. And by wisdom, I mean, like, the science of how our body has information that leads, and there's enough science behind it. But it's the same thing with mindfulness. Like, if your brain is the only thing that you think has control over you and your life and your quality of life, you're missing out on, one, the world around you, because your brain is just interpreting it. The world itself is going to bring you a lot of joy or pain, as the case may be. And your body also has a lot to offer. So I think the piece of mindfulness I really appreciate is that it just reminds me to quiet the brain so that I can be collecting data and experiencing other parts of life. That if my brain's in, you know, a million miles an hour, and I'm sure you can tell, like, I tend to talk fast and I have a really, like, kind of high frantic energy sometimes. So it'd be a person like me, it'd be really important. Otherwise my brain will be my captain, and there's a lot of other information that could bring good things to my life.
Can you explain a little bit more what you mean by the body has a lot to offer?
Yes. So, with my mom's practice, and this is, I feel really lucky, you know, she's a wonderful woman, and she talks about, she retrains your nervous system. She worked with a woman with rheumatoid or juvenile arthritis that she had since she was 13, hadn't tied her shoes, hadn't been able to feed herself soup. And in 3 months, my mom was able to help retrain the body through the nervous system. And how they do it is through micro movements, where your brain will catch it, but it needs your body to demonstrate it. And so she works with your physical body. Literally, she'll touch your hand or your shoulder and move you and your muscles for you, or ask you to, in ways that are contrary to your brain's automatic drive. And so that disrupts your brain's, you know, patterns and systems. And it sees, it's like, okay, why does my body feel weird? Why am I moving differently? Oh, wait, I just moved this new way, and actually it felt better and it worked better. Cool. Yeah. Noted. Next. And so that, like, using your body as a way to offer the information up the chain, as opposed to assuming I need to go for a run right now. I'm going to run 6 miles an hour. Here we go. Click the button on my timer and go. That's all from the brain. And the other piece is, like, heart coherence. Have you heard of this work?
A little bit.
I want to say the numbers right, but the moral of it is that, like, your heart as an organ brings a lot of electromagnetic energy to your emotional system. And there's that breathing and slowing down of your heart rhythm and getting it to a pace that's healthier for you and equilibrium, as they might say. It's that helps your brain, like, rationalize and level out your emotional balance and send a different piece of information down the chain. And I don't know if this is making as much sense, but the point is, like, it's not all going from the head down the spine. A lot of it's going up the spine if you'll listen to it. But the only way you can listen to that information that might make you thrive a little bit more physiologically or psychologically is if you're mm-hmm. mindful enough of it or open
yeah.
to it.
Yeah. There's a, I think I found this through Tim Ferriss. It's a Tony Robbins sort of meditation / mindfulness moment. And I think it was Tim Ferriss who shared it. And it was basically this heart focused meditation. Mm. And Tony Robbins basically brings you through this exercise where you think about just one of the happiest moments in your life and basically think about your heart. Actually, what he says is first, think about a hard decision you need to make right now. We all have hard decisions. What's something you've been putting off? What's a decision that you just don't want to make and that you're like, I have no idea what to do? Okay, so think about that. Okay, hold that for a second. Then he guides you through this sort of heart-focused meditation where you're thinking about the happiest moment in your life. You're out of your head, you're in your heart, and just sort of you're there for like 30 seconds, a minute or so. And then he said, okay, from this heart-focused place, what do you need to do? And when I did that, that was like, it was very powerful for me. So is that what you're talking about? The sort of thinking, quote unquote, thinking with your heart, leading with your heart as opposed to your head.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Awesome. And you can measure it too, like the electromagnetic frequencies. If you put up a monitor to it, your brain, it extends out about 3 feet, whereas your heart, it's about 3 yards. And you know, when you walk in a room and you feel someone's vibe and you're like, ooh, they're in a bad mood and you don't know what it is. It's an ambiguous tension and not everyone feels that. But like, that's the same thing. You are picking up on our own like radiant energy or our own frequency.
Yeah.
And when you're calmer, like it's a lot easier for you to be grounded and truthful as opposed to like reacting to stress or anxiety.
It's the reason why deep breaths help.
Here. Yeah. I forget to take them.
All right. So we have about 10 more minutes or so. Mm-hmm. So let's jump to the final question, which is the question that I ask everyone who comes on the People's Thought podcast. And that is, what is the biggest people-related challenge in your job? Interpret that however you wish.
What is the biggest people-related challenge? In terms of, I guess this is the only thing that's coming to mind right now. That's a great question. What HumanSide is trying to do, the number one thing that I need from people is openness and receptability. And you can't demand that, and I can't force it. And without it, it's not even about the business. It's about like the fulfillment for me and the conversations where I go to bed being like, oh, what a great day. And a lot of times it's like we are in a time, you know, in history where we move fast and we're engaged in technology and we think a million miles an hour and we have a million things to do. And so this, even I fall into that. And so the lack of being so intentional with our time, the lack of people being in a place to have the conversation is really what I'm trying to say. Yeah. You know, like I'm ready to talk about my feelings. Well, I can't right now. I've got a call in 5 minutes, but I need to talk about my feelings right now. And it's like those 5 minutes, neither of those two people in that interaction are going to get what they need from it. Mm-hmm. And so that's often like, I feel lonely in times kind of operating in a mode and wishing for people to be where I want them to be and in the conversations where I want to be having, and also for my own growth. And I'm having a hard time finding the right moments or finding the right people, and less in the business side and more on my own growth and personal side and community side of things is I feel like I'm missing a beat right now. And so my biggest people related challenge is finding like the right timing for where are these conversations happening and where can I get pushed. If I'm not in grad school anymore, because I miss that, you know, I knew if I walked into a lab, there would be stimulating conversations. And so I think, I don't know if that answers the question, but that's what came to mind.
I can totally relate to that. And I understand that. I think, and I've experienced this a little bit, at least, that some of the conversations are happening online. Have you played with that at all?
Nope. Okay. I have not is the answer to that question.
Okay. Is there a particular reason why, or you just feel like that's something that maybe you'll do in the future, or you just kind of made a decision that it's not something that you want to do right
it's
now?
It's just, it's not a strength I have, and so I've struggled to lean into it. And I work so much on the computer that the last thing I want to do is go there also for my own personal fulfillment.
I can understand that. No, I mean, so do you mean connecting with potential partners connecting with potential clients. So that's what I'm talking about. So are you talking about something different?
No, I think we're saying the same thing, but I do use like Skype and such, but in,
sure.
That's as simplistic as my technology is personally. Like I don't, so I'd be curious and I'll take an inventory of places, you know, where you connect and find people online. Cause other than going to events where I'm physically in person with people, which is, that's where I thrive. I'm very much an extrovert. So that's where I tend to lean towards.
And that makes total sense because I'm an introvert. So it's, it's funny. It's where we naturally gravitate towards. Yeah. I started and I still do the in-person networking and I do that but I have like the groups. There's three or four groups and like meetup groups that I will follow. SGO is one of them, Shaking So. Mass TLC is another one, the Mass Technology Leadership Council. And then there's a couple others. But that's, I don't see the in-person stuff as sort of, I see it as, I call it like, it's like the chicken soup for my soul, right? So when I go out and I network, it's more about just connecting at the human level and actually having that face-to-face and that human-to-human in-person interaction.
Yeah.
And if something comes out of it business-wise, awesome. If it doesn't, I still get that chicken soup, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah.
But I see online as sort of my main sort of driver for the business. Where are people? Facebook?
Yep.
Twitter. Mm-hmm. I started with Twitter. And then I was like, oh, and Facebook was kind of always like the, oh, I just use it for friends and family. But then a lot of folks who are doing similar things that we do have told me, oh, you got to check out Facebook for business kinds of things. I'm like, no, it's not going to work. But turns out lots of people are talking on Facebook. People respond on Facebook. And it works. So that to answer your question, where are people? Facebook and Twitter, at least to name the two big ones anyway.
We'll take an inventory of other resources that you use after this for sure.
Awesome. Great. So it was great talking with you, Katie. Wonderful conversation.
Thank you. Honored. This was great. Good start to my, what is it, Tuesday morning?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Sure.